This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Rabbi Neil Amswich of Temple Beth Shalom here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So you've been in Santa Fe a year and a half as Rabbi of Temple Beth Shalom, and we haven't had you on yet, but we thought that now, since it's Hanukkah, that would be a good time to talk about this holiday and perhaps other holidays in Judaism in general. But let's talk about Hanukkah first. What is this festival?
It's a lovely festival. It's two-sided. It's a festival that remembers a struggle. It was a struggle that the ancient Israelites had against a Syrian king who ransacked the temple, basically, and tried to install Hellenistic ideas on the Jewish populace. And some of them resisted. Some of them loved the ideas and went with it. Some of them, however, resisted. One of them who resisted, Mattathias, he ended up leading a revolt, basically, against these Syrian forces, led a guerrilla war, and eventually overtook the Syrian army, came back to the temple, rededicated it, took all the idols out. And so it's, for adults, it's a real story about overcoming very difficult odds and standing up for what you believe in. But then there's an extra story to it. The Talmud relates, many years after the original story came out in the Book of the Maccabees, the Talmud relates that there was a miracle of oil, that when they came back to the temple, the oil for the everlasting light, there was only enough oil for one day. But the nearest oil was 8 days away. But nonetheless, a miracle happened and the oil lasted. And that's the story that we tell kids. And it's a story about the light in the darkness, dispelling the darkness, which is particularly good in December when it gets very dark. So it's a two-sided story. In one sense, it's a story about overcoming very difficult odds and standing up for what you believe in. But on the other side, it's also a story about light and about dispelling darkness. It's a lovely, lovely festival.
Do you think it has any sort of solstice roots, the way a lot of winter festivals seem to have?
It's impossible to know. What we do know is that the festival has been mentioned since the Books of the Maccabees. So we know it's at least, it's over 2,000 years old. However, this idea of the candles, of the miracle of the light, is only about 1,500 years old, at least written down. But it could have been a much older idea. It could have been an original historical narrative, for all we know. So, yes, it could have roots, or it could be similar. I like to think, as a Reform rabbi, that there are certain truths which different faith communities have, and sometimes those truths are very similar to each other. And so, therefore, it may not have come from a solstice idea, but we may all be sharing similar thoughts and similar ideas.
It is nice to have light in the winter.
It is nice.
I guess it's a northern hemisphere kind of thing to be doing this in December.
Very definitely. I mean, of course, when you think about Jews who live in Australia, of course, this is the height of the summer. So it's a little bit odd to be lighting Hanukkah candles and putting them in the window when the sun doesn't go down until 10 o'clock in the evening. But here in the northern hemisphere, it's really lovely. We're taking our Hanukkah, our candelabrum, and we're adding candles to it every day, and we put it out in the window so that everyone who walks past can see. And it's a lovely public sharing of light. Actually, it's not just a thing for our own families. We share light and joy, so it's
lovely. That is compromised only during periods of oppression, when people need to hide and things like that.
It's very difficult. I mean, of course, here in Santa Fe, where we have an extremely tolerant community, extremely open community, I have found, there's no concern for that. There are, of course, communities around the world which find challenges. But the idea here of this story is that we're remembering that even if you are challenged, to stand up, actually, and to say, no, I'm proud to do this. There's a lovely story of a town, I think it's called Billings, where people in the 60s were putting bricks through windows of houses with Hanukkiot in the window.
Billings Montana?
I think that's right. And so what happened was everybody in the town got a Hanukkah and put it, Jew or non-Jew, put it in the window to say, no, we support the Jewish members of our community. So even in times of difficulty, it's an important thing to put it out in the window and say, look, we're proud to share this, actually.
Hanukkah and menorah, same thing?
They are the same thing. It's interesting, of course, because I'm British, we often have different words. Hanukkah is... really, the menorah is a seven-branched candelabrum, which was in the temple. The Hanukkah has nine branches, eight for the 8 days of Hanukkah and one for the shamash, one for the servant candle who helps us. So there is a very slight difference. A Hanukkah is a kind of menorah. It's a kind of candelabrum, but it has nine branches, not the seven.
So how do you celebrate Hanukkah at Temple Beth Shalom and in your family?
We have loads of things. We have a Lutka lunch coming up, actually, which is a wonderful thing. We have maybe 100 people who come and celebrate. Because of the miracle of the oil, there's a tradition to have oily foods.
And that sounds good.
It's very good. So we have Lutkas, these potato pancakes, and we have a huge lunch, and we have music, and a lot of people from the community and outside the community come and enjoy that. We also light the Hanukkah at services. So it's a very positive time. It's a very fun time. In families, we very often give each other presents, or we'll play a game with a dreidel, which is a spinning top, and you play for, it's like a little gambling game. You play for chocolate coins, and it's a teaching tool. The four letters on the dreidel not only represent whether or not you put money in or take money out or chocolate coins out, but it also teaches you. It's an acrostic for the letters are Nes Gadol Hayasham, a great miracle happened there. So as you're playing and you know, gambling with the kids, or you do it with raisins or anything like that, you're also teaching them the story as well. And you sing songs as well. There's lots of that.
The letters are not only letters, but concepts.
Yeah, essentially, it's spelling out these four letters that will tell you to put money in or put raisins in or to take half the raisins and so on. They also teach you that there was a miracle, that there was something different, something extraordinary that happened.
Now, you are a Reform rabbi.
Yep.
Explain to us what Reform Judaism is as opposed to Orthodox or conservative.
I like to think of this. All Jews, as far as I know, all observant religious Jews believe in what is known as Torah min hashamayim, which means Torah from heaven. That Torah, the five books of Moses or the Bible, has come from us, come to us from God. But we understand Torah min hashamayim, Torah from heaven, in different ways. So an Orthodox Jew may understand Torah from heaven being as literally dictated from God to Moses, word for word, letter for letter. Whereas in Reform Judaism, we might understand it more as a record of our encounter with God. Something so indescribably wondrous that it's impossible to describe, but nonetheless we tried. And so it presents Torah is a reflection of our first encounter with God, but it's also a reflection of us trying to describe that encounter with God. So I think the other difference for me that I really started to notice between, say, Orthodoxy and Reform Judaism is Orthodoxy tends to see the past as more glorious, that people in the past were more intellectually superior, that the better days were in the past. I think for me, Reform Judaism, at least for me, sees it differently, that actually that society continues to improve, and that I hope that my children are better than I am and learn more than I do, and that knowledge develops and grows. So I think those are differing concepts of differing ways to approach the world. Reform Judaism is particularly meant to be, and is very proud, especially at Temple Beth Shalom, extremely inclusive. So we appreciate different branches of Judaism and say, I understand that that's what you believe, and that's great. And I believe this, and a conservative Jew might believe something else, a renewal Jew something else. And our role is to sit together and to relate together as a community.
It sounds a little bit from what you're saying that reform is a little bit more like humanistic in its outlook. In other words, this is the human relationship towards scripture, whereas the more conservative or orthodox are a little bit more, how do I say it? We are lesser than the scripture itself. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. I don't think Reform Judaism is humanistic. I think it contains a very strong theological strand. For me, Reform Judaism is about encountering God in today's world, not abandoning the past. A famous Reconstructionist rabbi, Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan, talked about the past has a vote, not a veto. And I think for me, that's quite a powerful way of understanding Reform Judaism. But that doesn't mean that we are just moving ahead and it's all about us and our own personal development, because the encounter with divinity is key. The living with God, not just serving God, but living with God, knowing God, trying to bring God into our lives, trying to bring God into our very being and everything we do, I think is key as a Reformed Jew. So our prayer service, for example, and we get we can get 100 people at our prayer service on a Friday night. It's about us coming together to encounter God, to meet with God, to be with God, however we may understand God, but not being bound by scripture, rather not being bound by a narrow interpretation of scripture, rather reading scripture and saying, what is the text trying to say in its time? And now what does the text say to us in our time? Is that the same? Is it different? And if so, where do we meet God in that interpretation?
What does God mean to you?
That's a great question. I'm not sure. I think I spent a long time in my life trying to define God, trying to see God as somebody who oversaw the world and who created the world, and who was there for us and whom we could speak to. My philosophy and theology has changed from that somewhat due to some personal challenges in my life, due to some bereavements, and I found that instead of trying to define God, all I try to do is meet with God, is try to bring God into my life. Without interrogating. I struggle to know myself. And if I can struggle to know myself, how could I possibly know God? So for me, I encounter God by studying. I encounter God by being with other people, by performing mitzvot or commandments or good deeds. I encounter God when we're trying to engage in a very strong thing for Reform Judaism, which is tikkun olam, which is repairing the world. That's where we say, I think God was here. As opposed to trying to define and limit, because words can be so limiting. Rather, for me, it's about the experience of saying this was a holy moment, this was a sacred moment, this encounter was something that reminded me or that brought God in some way.
Can those encounters be engineered, for example, through religious services on a particular day of the week, that kind of thing?
Yes, I hadn't thought of it as engineered. I think for me, religious services, like the services we have at Temple Beth Shalom, can be extremely powerful because they set a mood. And as a rabbi, my role is to try to create the mood, to create different encounters with God. Sometimes there is a familiarity to the liturgy that we have, so that we can let go of a certain set part of ourselves so that our minds can go elsewhere. And sometimes our liturgy is very creative. So I guess we are engineering spiritual moments. I haven't thought of it like engineering, but I guess we are. We're perhaps not so much engineering, perhaps more creating in an artistic sense, allowing these moments to flow from us and with us. I think that's a little less defined than engineering.
Well, there are many people who don't believe in a supernatural God. Probably, if you're really honest, the vast majority of people don't believe in a supernatural God. But they have had these special moments in their lives, but often those things come kind of at random and often don't happen in church or temple or whatever. They might happen in nature. They might happen in some encounter with art or with another person or whatever it might be. And they can't be sort of like, okay, this is going to happen tomorrow because it's Sunday.
Right. The Jewish theologian Martin Buber talks of two different kinds of encounter, the I-it encounter and the I-thou encounter. And the I-it encounter is how we normally relate to everyone else as separate, bounded individuals. Occasionally, very occasionally, we have I-thou moments. These moments of extraordinary loss of self, the sense of connection with something greater than ourselves. And we can't engineer those. We can't create those. But what I can do in a prayer service is try to create spaces for them, or even try to create a mindset so that people can go out into the world and have those I-thou moments themselves. So I agree. There's nothing limiting about when we pray in a community. That's not the only time we encounter God. I would be profoundly challenged if that were the only time when people encounter God. The encounter we have with our children, with our partners, with our friends, with nature, everything, with our food, every moment has the potential for a spiritual encounter. And again, as you mentioned, the supernatural idea of God, we don't need to necessarily have God be a supernatural being to have those moments of encounter. All we need to do is realize this moment has sanctity. This moment is special and different and distinct. And that, I think, is where we start meeting God without having to define supernatural, transnatural, or anything similar.
We're talking to Rabbi Neil Amswich of Temple Beth Shalom. Do these ideas map at all onto a concept which is talked about a lot in Santa Fe, namely mindfulness?
I think probably, yes. I do find it interesting when I hear people talk in religious terms, but deliberately avoiding religious language and replacing it with something very similar. Where instead of saying God, they'll say the universe, or instead of saying prayer, they'll say self-reflection. Even though prayer in Hebrew, lehit palel, means to judge oneself, it is the act of self-reflection. So mindfulness, similarly, is a sense of being aware, as far as I understand it, a sense of being aware of greater things, of more unique, extraordinary things. And I think that is similar in a religious sense as well.
Or in a sense of being aware of the most ordinary things, but being aware of them. I mean, looking at a blueberry and you'd never noticed it before.
Right.
And it becomes this sort of like miraculous thing.
There is nothing ordinary in Judaism in some sense. Whatever we do, whatever we drink or eat or anything like that, we say a blessing beforehand. There are blessings. We're obliged in Judaism, according to one tradition, to say 100 blessings a day. That's a lot of blessings. And a blessing is an acknowledgement of the wonder of the universe. There are blessings on smelling flowers, on seeing a rainbow, on seeing the first blossom in spring, on seeing people of different appearance. There are so many different blessings that we can say. Morning blessings as we get up in the morning. Many people, they get up, they get dressed, they get a shower, not in that order, and they'll have their breakfast, and then they'll just get on with their day. In Judaism, there's a tradition of saying these morning blessings. There's even a blessing after going to the restroom to say, this was extraordinary that this worked. So it is a sense of being aware that there is nothing really very ordinary. Everything in our lives is extraordinary, even down to the blueberry.
I remember once getting horribly sick and thinking, what good can I find in this? And I thought, oh, my body knows exactly what to do. It's expelling the pathogens that it wants to get rid of. And it made me feel better.
The human body is truly extraordinary. I remember, and I will always remember, the first time we saw a scan of my daughter.
A scan? Like ultrasound?
Ultrasound of my daughter.
Before she was born.
Yeah. And I burst into tears. Yeah. I had never seen anything so extraordinary. as a heart beating inside another human being, a spine, toes, everything. And that, again, just reminded me of how mind-blowing the human body is, that overwhelmingly, not always, but overwhelmingly, it can create this beautiful life. And even when we're sick, the fact that our body knows what to do, hopefully, not always, but hopefully knows what to do. But even if it doesn't, and even if we succumb to illness, there's still an extraordinary wonder about the ability to still be aware of it. One of the things that we're most thankful for is the ability that we can be thankful. And so the fact that we are alive, even if we are struck down by illness, we're still alive, and that's still extraordinary.
Do you think that if you had seen that scan and it had just been some stranger's ultrasound, you would have reacted the same?
Almost certainly not, but I would have still been blown away, because it is, for me, it's just an extraordinary image. But of course, that was my daughter, so I'm biased.
So what is your training like to become a rabbi?
5 years of specific rabbinic training, which was at the Leo Beck College in London. You have to have a degree first, because the degree is an MA in Hebrew and Jewish studies. And because it is a demanding course, that's not just an MA, but it's also practical rabbinical training. How to balance budgets, how to deal with difficult congregants, how to write sermons, which of course a normal MA wouldn't cover. So they have to know that you can handle a degree. So I got a BSc in astrophysics first. So for me, I went from astrophysics, and then I had 2 years of rabbinic training in England. Then the third year is normally spent in another country. So I actually came to Philadelphia, to the Reconstructionist College there, which is where I met my wife. Who is also a rabbi. Then we went back to England for the final 2 years of my study, and she continued her study there.
Now, how did you go from astrophysics to being a rabbi?
I'd always been interested in astronomy. I didn't realize, actually, that where astronomy is looking at things and naming them and saying, aren't they lovely and pretty and wonderful? Astrophysics is, and how many photons come off that every second? And that wasn't as interesting as I had hoped it would be. But it gave me an appreciation, especially in the last year of astrophysics, of the sense of how little we know. There are certain things we can say very firmly, scientifically, but there is that element of doubt, that element of we just don't know, and also the element of isn't the universe extraordinary? That galaxies exist in clusters, that we can go down to your very small blueberry, and we can observe all of these things. So for me, there was a sense of wonder that took me there, I think. I used to think that where science gave the what, religion gave the why. But I'm not sure that's true anymore. I think both science and religion are asking a similar question, which is, how did we get here, and what does that mean? So for me, very often people talk about how do you reconcile the clash between science and religion, and I don't see a clash. I think they're asking the same question, they're just answering with a different language.
Well, I mean, the argument would be one requires proof and evidence and the other requires faith.
For me, it's not so much about faith. For me, religion, the proof and the evidence of existence is here already. That what is science trying to prove? What science does is it takes things and it breaks them down into smaller components. And what religion does is it tends to take things and make them larger. And I think we need both, actually, to be able to be to be able to look at the world in differing ways, to be able to see a grander view of the world. Because it's fine to look at the component parts of something, but if you forget the glory of the thing itself, the wonder of the existence of the thing, then you're missing something very profound. And I did find that in the scientific community, a very cold analytical sense. So while I was reading about these galaxies and stars, and I'm struck with wonder, everyone's writing down numbers, and I'm thinking something's being missed here. So, yes, of course, you need proof for a scientific formula to come forward. But I still think that's trying to answer a question. And the question is, what is this and why? And I think religion tries to do the same thing, or at least my understanding of Reform Judaism is we're trying to do the same thing. What is this? As in, what is this life and why? Why are we here?
I think that something that religion and mythology and poetry and art all do is look at the natural world and see symbol and metaphor and find very deep meaning in those things. And I don't know that science does that. I mean, the metaphor is an extrapolation from the phenomenon.
I think that's true. I think that's true. I think, and this is why I say, I think we need both in our lives. We need to be able to break down constituent parts, to look at minutiae and say, isn't this extraordinary? And this is how it works. This is how it functions. While at the same time looking at, while at the same time not forgetting the essence of being, and not forgetting the connection that we have, the internal connection that we can form with other things, other beings. And that we can create those connections through metaphor, through linguistic terminology, through just feelings, and creating certain sense of awe. I think awe is something that is often missing in science, that sense of wonder.
Although I've heard an awful lot of scientists who really have no use for religion at all, who are very clear and happy atheists, who find their awe and wonder in science.
That's true.
I mean, in that observation of the incredible, I mean, the diversity of species,
of
just
course.
As an example, or the complex systems and webs that connect those species.
I think that's true. I think if we're trying to get people to engage with those species, though, we need a different kind of language and terminology. A lot of the environmental work that I do actually relates to species preservation. And what we learn around the world is that the communities who tend to be more environmental are the religious communities, because they form relationships with nature, relationships with other beings through their mythology, through their terminology that reaches into the heart. That sometimes when you're describing something scientific, it can, even though you're absolutely right that there are many scientists who say, I have no need for formal religion, by which I think they misunderstand religion, by the way. I think they see it as very narrow and limiting. I think, however, we can see that religious communities and religious individuals tend to connect to the world in very strong, powerful ways that they can then transmit to their children. And so, I think there's a need for both.
We're talking to Rabbi Neil Amswich of Temple Beth Shalom, talking about Judaism, talking a little bit about Hanukkah. You were talking about environmentalism in the context of both religion and science. And what is your kind of work in environmentalism, and how does it relate to your religion?
I spent nearly a decade of my work in Bournemouth in the south coast of England. And when we were there, we realized that the faith communities were doing very little to address any environmental issues at all. So what I did was I called up 100 different faith communities and said, let's all get in a room and see what we can do. Let's talk about where our faith communities have something very similar, which is the earth. We all share the earth. We all have texts about the earth and traditions about the earth. So let's learn about each other. Let's appreciate. We all think the earth is sacred in some form or another. What does that mean?
Not everybody does. I mean, people are removing mountaintops.
I'm talking about the
people
faith communities.
People are clear-cutting. Oh,
sure, but I'm talking about the faith communities. In their traditions, have very clear messages about the importance of the earth. And so it is our responsibility to take those messages out into the wider world and say, look, we've been holding on to this message of the wonder of the world, and you are cutting the tops off mountains and destroying species at an extraordinary rate. We need to change the way that we think about the world.
So we set up, in the end, we set up something called the Big Green Believers Agreement, which was like, it was around the time of Copenhagen. And we created an agreement, for a binding agreement for communities. It took us a year to negotiate. And it was a binding agreement with different steps for different communities to be more environmental. By the end of my work in Bournemouth, we had 400 faith communities signed up. So that is the work that I had done in England. Coming over here, I've been learning the lay of the land at the moment. I work with the ILA, the Interfaith Leadership Alliance, which is a wonderful group of interfaith clergy in particular who come together and who try to make the world and Santa Fe in particular a better place. And one of the things we've started to look at is what do we do environmentally? So there's been a lot of work on that. There are also a number of Jewish festivals that relate to the environment. I also spoke at the hearings, the recent hearings about PNM. I didn't realize that PNM execs were going to be there when I was extremely critical of them. But I think it's important for faith leaders to have a voice, to stand up and to really say, this is sacred. And this, there is no, what is it, people are saying, there is no planet B. And we cherish this. In Judaism, we have a wonderful text known as Perek Shira, which is a chapter of song, basically. And in this text, Perek Shira, which is a later text, not a biblical text, every element of creation sings a song. It sings a praise of God in some form. And what very often it's a biblical phrase.
Like earthworms?
Earthworms, like the frog says, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchut Olam Va'ed. The frog says, blessed is God's glorious name, which is particularly clever because if you're listening to a frog and thinking Hebrew, the word Baruch almost sounds like a frog croak. Like Baruch. so it's particularly clever. So this text, Perek Shira, reminds us that every element of creation sings. It sings God's praise. And so we have a duty to protect that because there is a universal choir. And we can tap into that choir as we do in our prayer services. We join in with that choir, praising God. If, however, we stand by and let all the tenors and the baritones, you know, get chopped away, what are we left with? It's not as much of a song. And that, for me, is a very powerful religious message on why we should be working to protect the earth.
I mean, it's also a metaphor for biodiversity.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. I've often thought about this question of encountering the sacred, encountering what seems like a, I don't know, religious moment, encountering a kind of sense of happiness and connection. And it often, for me, is associated with sensuous and sensual happiness of one kind or another. Affection, a good meal, things
right.
like that.
Right.
And when you're hungry, really hungry, and I've never fasted to the point where you know, I had visions or something like that, and people go through that. I don't know if it's healthy or not. I don't know if it's real or not. But you tend not to think that the world is such a beautiful and friendly place. And there are moments where you feel like you're part of nature and you're all connected. And there are moments where you feel, especially if you've ever been cold and hungry and scared out in the woods, a little too far from your car kind of
sure.
thing, where nature does not seem friendly at all. It seems like a place where you could live a meaningless life and die a horrible death, which really, you know, the vast majority of creatures probably have in one way or another. I mean, maybe for them it's not horrible, but maybe it is.
The idea that, is it nature is red in tooth and claw is real. Just because the whole world, if we take this metaphor from Perek Shira, that the every species, including the trees, all sing God's praises, that doesn't mean that everything on earth is lovely. That doesn't mean that everything is herbivorous, for example. Certainly, there's a prophetic idea that in the future, a very long distant future, according to the Bible, that hopefully the wolf will lie down with the lamb and so on. But that's talking about a very different state of being. What we have is that nature can be very cruel. Life can be very cruel. We know that. And I think it's not the role of religious communities to ignore that. I think we need to be able to find God in that. there's a very powerful blessing. To go back to the idea of blessings, as I said earlier, one of the blessings that we have is a blessing on hearing bad news. And people say, why would you say a blessing then, of all the times? But the answer is because that's part of life. Because death and illness and loss is and injury is part of life. And so we need to be able to find God in those moments too. So yes, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that nature can be cold and dark and scary and violent, and God is still there.
Is that your felt experience?
I think so. I think it came from, that was something I learned. It was actually just before I went to Philadelphia. I had a very close friend of mine who was killed in a very brutal way. And I found it very difficult to square that with my theology. And I slowly came to learn that God is in loss and death and murder. And being able to experience God there too was very important for me. It was a real turning point for me theologically. I don't think religion is about all the nice stuff in the world. Religion is about meeting God in a world that can be wondrous and beautiful and also very difficult and challenging and dangerous sometimes.
We're talking to Rabbi Neil Amswich of Temple Beth Shalom. So you are a Reformed Jew. You are married to a rabbi also. How do you work together as a two-rabbi family? First of all, is this a Reformed Judaism thing, like where men and women are both rabbis? Is that the only division of Judaism where women can be a rabbi?
Reformed Judaism was the first branch of Judaism to accept women rabbis. It's for the last 30 or 40 years, actually. And there, for us, we really move Judaism beyond gender. I appreciate that Judaism has been a very gendered religion in the past. The Torah is clearly a gendered document. It's for men, about men, by men, and how women fit into that system. Later rabbinic law was written for men, about men, by men. There's even a tractate of law called Women, because how do we deal with women? And that was how the rabbis, the early rabbis, understood gender roles. I wrote a thesis on transsexual surgery in Judaism, and what does that mean for us? It was actually extraordinary to explore it at Temple Beth Shalom. And so for us in Reformed Judaism, we're not bound by gender. Of course, if we wish to identify with our gender and use it to connect to God or to connect to each other in different ways, then that's great. But we don't limit people because of their gender or their sexuality or their race or anything like that. So how do we work together? Well, Jenny, Rabbi Jenny, is actually she's the director of our preschool. We have an amazing preschool at Temple Beth Shalom. It has Jewish children and non-Jewish children who come together. And that's actually a very powerful message of Reformed Judaism. It's about inclusivity, about bringing people in and respecting other people's faith traditions. She doesn't lead services at the temple at the moment. That's more my role. Her role at the moment here is at Temple Beth Shalom is as a preschool director. Back in England, I was the principal rabbi and she was the associate rabbi. It's not often when you get married rabbis that they work together. Just because sometimes, you know, it creates tension in the marriage and so on. We seem to work extremely well together, and it's a really good pairing. And clearly Temple Beth Shalom saw it, and so now we work together in different ways.
But if you had laryngitis, maybe she'd take over for that.
Absolutely. She could. One of the strengths of Temple Beth Shalom, though, that I've found compared to other communities that I've experienced, is how very strong the lay leadership is, and how members of the community can step up. We have a cantor, we have a music director, and they have led services in my absence before. But there are also members of the community who can stand up and lead services and give sermons, and they're very exciting and interesting to hear as well. So that's, but yes, in theory, Rabbi Jenny could come in and she could lead a service as well if need be.
One thing that's always kind of puzzled me about Judaism, and it actually worried me a little bit about Judaism, is this idea that Jews are the chosen people. What does that mean to you, and what does that mean about everybody else?
What does it mean to be chosen? As a rabbi, I feel chosen to do a task. But that's a choice that's not imposed upon me. It just feels like something I need to do.
Yeah, well, I feel that way as a talk show host, but that's not anything that came from God.
So, well, it depends. It doesn't come from a supernatural God saying, Mary Shiloh, you should be a...
No, but it also isn't about a group of people. I mean, you're talking about an individual.
Okay, so I was going to go from there to the idea of being called. I think groups of people can feel called to a particular task. Chosenness, which interestingly has moved away, has been not entirely taken out, but very greatly taken out from the Reform liturgy. It carries a sense of superiority when people are looking at it from the outside. But that's not the idea. The idea is we have Torah. And so we as Jews follow Torah. The expression, how odd of God to choose the Jews, it was not odd, the Jews chose God. I like to see Judaism, or I like to see being a Jew, not as being chosen, but as being choosing. I think particularly post-Holocaust, every Jew is a choosing Jew.
What does that mean?
Because after the Holocaust, after Jews were systematically wiped out just for being Jewish, not for engaging in Judaism, but just for the fact that they were a Jew, regardless of their practice. Anyone after the Holocaust who says, I am a Jew, is a choosing Jew. They're choosing to identify. So for me, Judaism is not about being chosen, but it's about choosing. So I prefer to see being Jewish as being part of the choosing people. We choose to engage in tikkun olam, in repair of the world. We choose to encounter God through a Jewish lens. And that, I think, is also a very important message to send out to the rest of the world. Not we are chosen, we are better, or anything like that, which never is what it was. It was always...
No, but it can be used that way.
It can be, but of course it can. But every thought process and every religious metaphor and every religious notion can be twisted and can be turned to something selfish and personal. The role of organized communities, I think, is to make sure that it doesn't become that, in theory at least. Certainly in Reform Judaism, that's our ethos, to try to make sure that our Judaism is progressive, is forward-thinking, is dynamic, is inclusive, not selfish, not demanding on others, not excluding others. So for us, it's more about choosing than chosen, I would say.
It's funny that you say that, because I have a close friend who's Jewish, and she's an absolute atheist. I mean, never goes to any services, doesn't believe in it, in any of that stuff. But she identifies as a Jew, and I said, why? She said, because when the time comes, they'll take me away in the middle of the night.
I completely respect that. I struggle with that slightly. And the reason I struggle with that slightly is because of the negative identification.
Yeah, it's a totally negative identification. It's the identification, very understandable, of fear.
Of course. And yet, that can be the grounding for a very positive identification, for a very positive connection between family, tradition, even things like chicken soup or something, you know, something very stereotypical and silly and simple. But actually, within people who choose, you can be an atheist who doesn't believe in anything to do with scripture or anything like that, or any kind of sense of formal prayer, but actually still engage in Jewish things without realizing. As I said, lehit palel, to pray, is to reflect. And I think people often sit down, even if they see themselves as an atheist, will sit down and reflect. I see that as a religious action. If they choose not to, that's fine. I would like to hope that people who connect to Judaism out of fear, essentially, that sense of they will still come to get me, can hope to see, like communities like Temple Beth Shalom, and see the joy in being Jewish. And what we do in our community is we don't insist on any theology. I don't insist that every time we read a prayer, I don't turn to everyone and say, and you must believe that. Rather, I would rather people stopped and explored the prayer while the rest of us are praying and challenge themselves. So for me, being part of a community like Temple Beth Shalom is about seeing the joy in Judaism, the love of a community, even something as simple as a Hanukkah lunch.
So we are now, let's see, it's Tuesday, so we're on the third day of Hanukkah.
It will be third day tonight, yeah.
Yeah. And so are there things that non-Jews participate in, like any of the food traditions?
Can be. Of course, one of the great things about Reform Judaism, particularly in this country, has been to bring in non-Jewish members of families, to bring in mixed faith couples. And we have a good number of them in our community. We don't bring people in order to convert them, but just to say, two individuals here love each other. One happens to be Jewish, one happens not to be Jewish. How do we help you all participate as a family if you choose to in Jewish rituals? So absolutely, from family to family, we try to encourage people, and friends as well, we try to encourage people to participate however they wish.
Tell us a little bit more about the interfaith work you do. How do you work with people from other churches, synagogues, things like that, and maybe not Reform, but Conservative Orthodox? And what do you do together? Like, where's the common ground?
There are some festivals where we come together as for the intra-faith, for the Jewish community. There are a few other communities in town, and we will come together to celebrate those festivals. Also, the leaders of those communities, the rabbis of those communities, almost all of us will actually come to my office. I have a big round table, and we call it the Rabbi's Round Table. And we sit and share things in our community and learn from each other and explore how to take the community at large further forward. That's a very positive thing that's only started recently, that I'm very proud to have brought to the town. Interfaith, Temple Beth Shalom has a very strong relationship with Christ Lutheran Church. We help them for one festival, they help us for another festival. We plant trees together, for example, for the festival of Tu B'Shvat, which is a lovely thing. One year will be on our campus and the next year will be on their site. But I think for me, the ILA, the Interfaith Leadership Alliance, is where the real interfaith work is really starting to take off.
And there's real social justice work there.
Yes, there is.
Which we haven't even talked about, that is a huge part of Jewish tradition as well as large parts of Christian tradition.
Absolutely. For me, particularly again as a Reformed Jew, Judaism is not about just sitting and studying. It's about making the world better. If your faith is so insular that it's not making the world a better place, what's the point? We are commanded to go out and to help the widow and the orphan and the oppressed, and that is the essence of Judaism. Not necessarily, you know, worrying about the minutiae of tiny legal matters, that is this or is this not kosher, if it's here or there. That can be important, but that can't be the only part of Judaism. It has to be world-changing. And I believe every faith community that has a vision that is world-changing, that is positive and helps people, can work together. And that is where the ILA comes in, the Interfaith Leadership Alliance comes in. And I think in the next year, we're going to be seeing a lot more of the ILA. We're going to be seeing a lot more of faith communities really standing up and speaking out against injustice and really coming forward and saying, we want change and we demand change, essentially. And now we're going to work towards it. I think there's going to be a lot more of that.
Rabbi Neil Amswich is the rabbi of Temple Beth Shalom. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and happy Hanukkah.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.